You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Dr. Peter E. McCarry, the executive for Middle East and Europe for the Global Ministries of the United Church of Christ and Christian Church. Dr. McCarry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's very good to be with you.
Dr. McCarry, how would you like to be referred to, as Dr. McCarry or Peter?
Peter is fine.
Okay, Peter. I saw something this month on the internet, a letter that actually went out from your organization and others, I think it was 15 other organizations, religious leaders of those organizations, to Congress, asking Congress to condition Israeli military aid on human rights compliance. I want to get into that in great detail in a moment, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are and on the church that you're with?
Sure. Thank you very much again, Dave, for the chance to be with you. I serve in the position, as you described, as executive for the Middle East and Europe in Global Ministries of the United Church of Christ and Christian Church Disciples of Christ. We are two American Protestant denominations that have been engaged in mission in the Middle East and around the world for a number of years. And I have particular responsibilities for the regions described. That includes our relationships with partner churches and organizations in the region, as well as education and advocacy here in the United States related to the issues pertaining to the Middle East and Europe.
Okay. And give a little bit of background about the church.
Sure. The United Church of Christ is a U.S. denomination of about 1.2 million members, and the Christian Church Disciples of Christ has about 750,000 members. I serve in the national office of the UCC and Disciples, so have the opportunity to represent our two churches. They are churches that have long histories in the United States. The United Church of Christ goes back to 1957, but includes churches that have a much longer history, including congregational strands as well as immigrant German strands. Some from the Hungarian side of immigration into the U.S., as well as others. So the UCC has a history that predates that of the United States, as a matter of fact. And the Christian Church Disciples of Christ also has a 200-year history that goes back into the early 1800s.
Wow, I didn't realize that. And how big is that relative to the other denominations?
Well, we are two smaller denominations, but still we think that we have an opportunity and an ability to participate in the national discourse as well as participate as faith communities in ways that are meaningful for our members and for our engagement in the world.
How long have you served with the church, Peter?
I've served in this capacity since the year 2000, and before that have served with churches overseas, including the Middle East Council of Churches and partner organization in Egypt as well.
And I had looked up online the church, and there's a lot of notable people who are members of the church. And I guess one of them I was unaware is President Barack Obama.
Yes, President Obama was a member of the United Church of Christ. And of course, that became an issue in the earlier campaign 4 years ago.
Yeah, well, that's politics for you, right?
Now,
let's get to this letter. Well, I saw online a story from October 5th. And this is from the Presbyterian Church's website. And it says, religious leaders ask Congress to condition Israel military aid on human rights compliance. I read the entire letter that was sent to Congress, and I just want to ask several questions about that, if I could.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay, so it says here that the signers say they have worked for decades to support both Israelis and Palestinians in their desire to live in peace and well-being, and have witnessed the pain and suffering of Israelis as a result of Palestinian actions and of Palestinians as a result of Israeli actions. Has your church worked for decades in that region?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we have. I would say that all of the churches that are participant in this letter as signatories have been involved in issues of domestic concern as well as international interests for a number of years and for a long period of time. Issues such as U.S. budget, foreign aid to Colombia, for example, a variety of issues, including the Middle East. Some of the churches who are part of the group of signatories have direct ties to churches in the region, such as the Orthodox churches and the Catholic churches, as well as Lutheran churches, and others of us have strong missionary relationships with churches in the region. Our churches, the United Church of Christ and Disciples of Christ, have a long history going back into the early 1800s in the Middle East, mission history that includes mission in Israel and Palestine. And so we do have an engagement in the region that is part of our history, as well as current engagement with a variety of churches through ecumenical relationships and other organizations in the region today. So indeed, we are actively engaged stage. And if you look at our set of policy on Middle East that have been adopted at our general gatherings as churches, you'll find, as I said earlier, a significant engagement with international issues, including the Middle East, so that the Middle East is not the only area where we are actively engaged, but it is certainly one where we have a particular interest given that mission history and given the faith history. Of course, Christianity's own history dates back 2,000 years to that part of the world. So as churches, we have a certain affinity with the region.
And specifically with this region, generally, how are you and the church received by the residents of Israel-Palestine?
As I said, we have strong mission relationships, partnerships with churches and organizations there. So, you know, our engagement has been primarily with Palestinian Christians, but we have also been engaged with Israelis and other Palestinian groups and organizations there. So, you know, our engagement is one of commitment. It's one of commitment to peace and justice. We've been eager to play a role in continuing to promote peace for both Israelis and for Palestinians, and one that focuses on issues of justice.
Let me get right into the letter. You say here that you have witnessed widespread Israeli human rights violations committed against Palestinians, including killing of civilians, home demolitions, and forced displacement, and restrictions on Palestinian movement, among others. And the letter also notes the deteriorating conditions in Israel. The next paragraph says that, and I guess this is the crux of the letter, unfortunately, unconditional U.S. military assistance to Israel has contributed to this deterioration, sustaining the conflict and undermining the long-term security interests of both Israelis and Palestinians. And you reference the most recent 2011 State Department country report on human rights practices covering Israel and the occupied territories, which details widespread Israeli human rights violations committed against Palestinian civilians, many which involve the misuse of U.S.-applied weapons. This report, of course, it's 2011. Do you happen to know when it was released?
No, I'd have to go back and look at the exact date of issuance.
The reason I was asking was because your letter just comes this month, and I was wondering, was it that report that precipitated the letter, or was it the market increase in settler violence against Palestinian civilians, or was it something else?
I would say it's a combination of those, but more importantly, it comes as a result of our engagement with the people there. As it says in the letter, we have worked alongside Palestinian Christian sisters and brothers for many years, and through our visits and through our listening to the conditions there, we're very attuned to the ongoing impact of Israeli occupation of the West Bank and control of Gaza, the impact of continuing settler construction, the continuing impact of the separation barrier, the killings of civilians, the denial of access between one part of the West Bank and another, and the denial of access to Jerusalem, for example. All of these are examples of the ways that the Palestinians have been affected as a result of occupation. So that, plus the documentation in the State Department's report, as well as other kinds of documentation, led us to issue this letter and to raise this issue as a concern. The substance of the letter is one that we are committed to continuing to engage in discussion and dialogue on, and look forward for the opportunity for that dialogue to continue. This opportunity that you've provided is a good one to get the word out and to discuss this continuing situation of occupation and the reality that the U.S. contribution through military assistance to Israel is having an impact, is helping to perpetuate some of those violations of human rights.
Mm-hmm. The letter continues, it says, accordingly, we urge an immediate investigation into possible violations by Israel of the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act and the U.S. Arms Export Control Act, which respectively prohibit assistance to any country which engages in a consistent pattern of human rights violations and limit the use of U.S. weapons to, quote, internal security or legitimate self-defense. Do you think that, Peter, it is possible violations by Israel? Or do you think it's pretty much definite violations by Israel? And also, you use the word consistent pattern of human rights violations. Do you think that that's also the case, that it is consistent? So it's not possible, but it's actual.
We believe that the violations are actual. We would call on Congress to investigate these violations and the possibility that they're violating U.S. law so that Congress is consistent in its application of U.S. law internationally. The ways in which Congress holds a variety of countries around the world accountable for U.S. foreign assistance, including military aid, those are not ways that the Congress engages with Israel, to our observation. So we are asking Congress to hold Israel to a standard of application of U.S. law that is consistent with the way Congress applies U.S. law in other situations.
And you say here that more broadly, we urge Congress to undertake careful scrutiny to ensure that our aid is not supporting actions by the government of Israel that undermine prospects for peace. We urge Congress to hold hearings to examine Israel's compliance, and we request regular reporting on compliance and the withholding of military aid for noncompliance. Now, I want to ask, Peter, how was the letter delivered and who was it delivered to?
Well, first of all, let me say that we're concerned about violations of human rights generally, but we are particularly, as U.S. churches, concerned about the application of U.S. law and the possibility that our tax money is being used to perpetuate violations of human rights. So we're speaking both from a general point of view as well as a particular U.S. church's point of view and the interest that we have as U.S. citizens. This letter was delivered to congressional offices on October 5th. You alluded to the date earlier, and it was delivered to various congressional offices, and we know that this is an election season, but we also expect that Congress will take the concerns seriously, whether that is in the near term or the medium term. You know, these are concerns that are ongoing and ones that aren't bound by a short time frame. And so we hope that we will receive a positive response from Congress on this, just as Congress does hold other countries accountable to U.S. law.
You haven't heard from Congress yet.
We have not. I believe we've heard a couple of acknowledgments of receipt, but in terms of substance of the letter, we have not received responses.
Okay. And it was sent to everyone that has jurisdiction over this matter, or everyone?
To the congressional offices.
All of them?
Yes.
Have you ever delivered a letter to Congress before?
The churches have been engaged in advocacy on a variety of issues and sometimes do engage together and other times engage separately as individual churches. There are certainly instances where letters have been delivered to Congress. One example from the United Church of Christ was around the time of the U.S.-led war against Iraq in 2003. So that was another example of delivering a letter of raising concern to the highest offices in U.S. government.
Okay, and have you gotten results from those letters?
Well, there are two aspects of these letters. One is a direct request to Congress that we hope will be heeded. We know that we've received support from a variety of people and organizations out there, so hopefully this is lifting the profile of this particular issue so that people also in their settings can take this as an issue to their congressional representative. But there's also the aspect of public witness, and that's something that's important to our churches as well, to speak out on issues that we feel have a theological and moral basis on which to speak out, and that churches have a unique role in presenting points of view. So in terms of lifting the level of profile and opportunity for engaging in dialogue and discourse on such issues, this is just as important for us.
The letter goes on to say that Israel is the single largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid since World War II, and that specifically repeated demands by the U.S. government that Israel halt all settlement activity have been ignored. And you also say that since 1967, and that was the Six-Day War, where Israel illegally took over these territories that are the point of contention here for all these decades. Since 1967, every U.S. administration has declared Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories as obstacles to peace, and that since the Oslo Accords in 1993, the number of Israeli settlers in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, has more than doubled.
Yes.
Why does the church think that the Israelis completely ignore U.S. demands?
Well, one of the reasons is spelled out in this letter, and that is that U.S. aid to Israel has essentially been free-flowing without the conditions and without the holding to account of possible violations of U.S. law and contradiction to the points of view of the U.S. government. And certainly, we as churches are very concerned with violations of human rights and those kinds of violations for any country in the region and globally. But in terms of Israel-Palestine, we've been deeply engaged on this issue and believe that for there to be a true, just, and lasting peace agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians, that the U.S. needs to step up its level of enforcement of U.S. law and holding Israel to account for these violations. Israel is the U.S. best friend. We send roughly $3 billion of military aid to Israel each year. And that being the largest amount of aid that we send to any country, certainly need to ensure that it's spent according to U.S. foreign policy positions and in accordance with U.S. law.
Why do you think that Congress doesn't hold Israel accountable? Do you know if Congress holds other recipients of U.S. foreign aid accountable?
Well, I mean, two clear examples are, last year when the Palestinians brought the issue of statehood to the United Nations, Americans, then humanitarian aid was suspended. So here's an example of the way that Congress does have mechanisms in place to review foreign assistance. Similarly, since the elections in Egypt after the revolution there and the change in regime, U.S. Congress has been engaged in an effort to review the foreign aid that the United States sends to Egypt. So we know that there are mechanisms in place to hold foreign countries accountable, but we just haven't seen evidence of that in the case of Israel, which continues to, as I said, engage in construction settlement, engage in killing of civilians, home demolitions, you named them as well earlier.
It's been well documented that one of the most powerful lobbies in the United States is the Israel lobby in its many forms, most specifically AIPAC, which is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Has the church or have you looked at this organization, the Israel lobby in general, as an obstacle to the United States not really getting paid attention to in its requests for Israel to honor human rights, to work on a long-lasting peace, even though Israel is, as the letter pointed out, the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid since World War II?
Well, we certainly know that AIPAC, for example, is a very powerful lobby and that there are many allies to AIPAC. And we, too, are engaged in advocacy and want our representatives in Washington and our elected officials in Washington to know that voices such as AIPAC aren't the only voice and that there are many who are concerned with the well-being of the Palestinians as well as the Israelis and seek a just and peaceful resolution to the conflict, one that takes into account the situation of settlements, of the continuing construction of the separation barrier, as well as issues related to refugees and control of Gaza. So all of these issues are very much ones that are of concern to us, ones that we hope will continue to get the kinds of attention that will raise people's awareness about the reality on the ground and then prompt them to engage with their elected officials in Washington.
Now, I also saw something online, an article about a response to the letter by a Jewish group. Have you been attacked by any Jewish groups through the media? And if so, in what forms?
Well, we did receive critique by various Jewish organizations because of the letter that was issued, and those are in the form of public statements, and you can find those online. Our feeling is that we would very much like to engage in a discussion with some of our Jewish colleagues, and particularly those with whom we're engaged in dialogue on the substantive issues of the letter, and I hope that that can happen.
Now, you mentioned also before about the media. Has the mainstream media contacted you at all about your letter?
Yes, we've had opportunities to discuss this with some major media outlets in the United States and as well as abroad. There was an article that appeared in the New York Times last Sunday, October 21st. Similarly, there has been interest in the Huffington Post about the letter and the response. And so those kinds of major media are examples of the kinds of attention that this letter has received.
And finally, how long are you going to give Congress to respond to the letter? And if you don't hear from them, is there a next step?
Well, as I said earlier, this is not an issue that appears to be going away anytime soon. So we are hopeful that Congress will consider the request in the letter and the substance of the letter sooner rather than later, but will continue to speak out on this issue.
Dr. Peter E. McCarry, the executive for Middle East and Europe for the Global Ministries of the United Church of Christ and Christian Church. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners and looking forward to speaking to you in the future and getting updates on this letter.
Thank you very much, Dave, again, for this opportunity.